Welcome to Complete Curiosity, the podcast that addresses the big questions in little segments.
Hello, and welcome to our 10th and last webinar in the COVID series. We've done a number of different webinars, and just refresh your memory on some of the topics that we've covered over the last kind of 2.5 months. So please do have a look on our website. They're all on our website. The webinars, they've also been converted into podcasts as well. So if you haven't got time to watch, just have a listen whenever you possibly can. That would be fantastic. Well, over the last sort of 10 weeks, I know you've been sharing your thoughts, but what we're kind of coming to a summation of this. What's really kind of sticking in your mind and challenging you at the moment?
Well, I think we started this entire journey in March talking about the fact that COVID-19 was literally just the latest wicked problem to beset mankind. So it's really been going December, January to June so far. But it's easy to forget that just prior to COVID getting a grip of the globe, we were consumed with this, you know, over the sort of months from November over Christmas through to February, where Australia was on fire. And that was the wicked issue that we were all concerned with, which slightly eclipsed the fact that Indonesia was underwater. So one part of the world was on fire, one part of the world was flooding. And of course, over the last 4 years, we've had this political wicked problem here of Brexit, you know, really
hasn't just finished yet, Alan.
No, I know. And that's the problem. And that's one of the things about wicked issues. And when we're talking about COVID-19, as will it ever end? You know, will we be in this perpetual distancing, social distancing? You know, will we get a second spike, a third spike, and so on? And that's part of the issue with wicked issues, is they're constantly evolving. But if I can remind you, back in October, so just a couple of months earlier than that, we had the Extinction Rebellion, which is about climate change, of course. And so COVID is just the latest wicked issue. And wicked issues, not wicked in the terms of evil, but in terms of super complicated, and they are all man-made. So these problems are not created by dolphins or trees. They're created by human beings. And they have six qualities. They're multidimensional, which I'll come to in a moment. They have lots of causes. So COVID doesn't have one cause. It has multiple causes. And it manifests in lots of different ways, as people have seen. There are multiple stakeholders. Lots of people have got an opinion or a dog in the game, if you will. And it will require lots of different solutions to fix any of these issues that we've been seeing. And to this point, it's not gone away. It's constantly evolving. So the Brexit thing, constantly evolving. The climate debate, constantly evolving. You know, viral pandemics and what to do about it, constantly evolving. So over the course of these 10 webinars, we've seen all of these six qualities of wicked issues at play. And that's what we've been trying to cover over these webinars. So we talked at length about the personal impact. You know, how does this affect me? And what does this mean for me as a single human being? What do I need to do differently? And what are the consequences? We've talked about, you know, collaborative communities and cultural impact and how it's changed the nature of how we relate to each other, either in the home or outside the home. And we've talked about, well, what does the world need to do differently? So that's the multidimensional nature of a wicked issue. And we've unpacked some aspects of the I, the we, and the it, as we would call it. We've also talked about, you know, the causes. So it's a zoonotic disease, which means it's basically hosted in, you know, ducks. And this virus jumps in to human beings. So it jumps species. And, you know, there's been quite a debate about, you know, is that to do with food security in different parts of the world, that, you know, food security isn't what it should do, which is promoting a number of these types of diseases, and they're on the rise. So it's maybe the way that we're living and doing food security. But of course, even if it jumped, one of the things that then disseminated the virus very rapidly was our propensity to travel. And we're incredibly social animals. It goes all over the world, right? And everything's globalized. So we've seen in some of our clients, as we've discussed, their response has been globalized. So globalization is part of the multiple causes, and not forgetting that viruses are in a sort of ecosystem balance with bacteria, and bacteria in ecosystem balance with mankind. And so we've talked about that and the sort of virulution. There's a very good book called Virulution about how viruses affect.
Is that an actual word, or is that just a book?
Well, I think it's a neologism, you know, which means a new word coined by an author. But it's kind of nice because viruses are part of humans' evolution. In fact, human beings wouldn't exist if it wasn't for viruses. If we eradicated all viruses in the world tomorrow, human beings would disappear, you know, within a few years. So humans are in an ecological ecosystem with all other species, of course, particularly viruses. So it makes a sort of the debate more complicated. So, you know, wicked problems are super complex problems, multiple dimensions, multiple causes. And because there is multiple causes, it creates multiple symptoms. And we did speak at length, as you remember, across these webinars about the six ways. So, of course, first of all, it affected us medically and psychologically. So that was a health issue. And then the sort of overwhelm of all health systems. And I think Brazil's currently, you know, top of the charts in terms of the health system overwhelm, not least because the political leader there has an interesting response. So that was wave two. Economic, we've seen the spike in unemployment in America, and certainly it's going to happen in UK. So there could be economic consequences which are starting to get a grip. And then I think it was last week or the week before, we were talking about collaborative communities and the impact across all systems. And ultimately, the sixth wave is all the unintended consequences of all of this. So that's the multiple symptoms dimension of a wicked problem. And, you know, the multiple stakeholders, as we've seen, that's all of us. Everybody has been talking about COVID, and everybody's got an opinion and a point of view about what needs to happen and how do we change and all of that. So every person on the planet is effectively a stakeholder in this pandemic. And, you know, there isn't just a simple soundbite answer, despite what most of the media outlets would want. Oh, let's all just take hydroxychloroquine. It's not as simple as that. And that's because it's a wicked issue. And in wicked issues, things are never simple. There are multiple causes, so you need multiple answers. So it doesn't lend itself to simple news cycles. We have talked about some of the aspects, and these are themselves quite complicated things. You know, maybe the silver lining is we realize the unbelievable importance of emotional regulation. And over this webinar series, we've talked at length about before you do anything in trying to respond to a health emergency, first port of call is manage your emotions. Manage your emotions, because if you don't, you can't think clearly. And then, you know, rather than a new balance, we talked in this webinar series about finding a new meaning, because that will take you into post-traumatic growth, not post-traumatic stress. So part of the solution is emotional regulation, finding meaning so you can turn, you know, the challenge into an opportunity, and how we change our relationship to each other. So there's lots of solutions that can be enacted today, and we can start getting better at that. And this is what we wanted to talk about in this webinar, which, because it's constantly evolving, the COVID landscape, what can we expect in the weeks and months ahead? So I just wanted to present one slide about that. So what's coming?
You know, had some thoughts about what do we do? What's the expectation?
Yeah, and that there's going to be changes large and small. So here's some sort of, challenge to thinking, and make people, you know, come up with a few questions, hopefully. What can we expect moving forward? So I've kind of pulled out, you know, a dirty dozen, if you will. Some things relatively small and simple. I think social distancing is going to be with us for some time, for quite a considerable amount. So even if it's true and we, you know, we open up the shops on the 12th of June in the UK, people will still be distancing, you know, in those shops. And probably through September and October, we'll probably be walking along paths and see somebody coming in the opposite direction, and we'll give each other a wide berth, even if there's no medical reason to do so. So that's going to be in play. People will be thinking about this, much more kind of cautious about their health and the propensity to get infected by others. So I think that's going to be with us for some time to come. And mask wearing, and I know that's not been terribly popular in the UK, but it's massive in Asia. But I think we'll actually start adopting that, particularly when you're in public spaces and confined public spaces like public transport. I think we're going to see an uptick in people wearing masks and not being afraid to wear masks in public in the UK. So that's a sort of small change. I think hygiene is going to be massive moving forward, not only at home, you know, as people think much more carefully about hand sanitization and just cleanliness. We've all become much more aware of that. But also in public spaces, in gyms, in offices, which may not be a bad thing, is, you know, we'll be living in a cleaner world. But of course, there's some, like with all wicked problems, there's some good sides and bad sides to that hygiene. You know, are we using cleaning products good for the environment, for example? So I think that's going to be a massive issue. And so, you know, organizations around the world that make cleaning equipment can probably look to a sort of brighter tomorrow, certainly in the short term. So I think hygiene is going to be a big issue for us. And as I've already mentioned...
Jyoti there, Alan, just a point from Jyoti. You wonder why we need masks when we have social distancing. It'd be great if it was one or the other. Do we need both?
Probably masks are probably more important. Certainly if you look at the data from Hong Kong, which we're going to come to a bit later, if it's difficult for you to socially distance, a mask is probably more useful to you than standing, you know, 6 feet away. Because if you look at any of the data on droplet transmission, which is what this is, if somebody coughs, those droplets can go some considerable distance. Now, we haven't got to the bottom of this about, you know, droplet transmission, because it's probably true to say you need to be in contact with aerosolized droplets of virus for long enough. So this is something that hasn't really been talked about. Like, how long do you have to need, you know, you need to be in the presence of droplet transmission in the air to get the infection? So again, we haven't really unpacked that in the media at all. And is it true to say that one of the reasons we're seeing a much higher incidence in health service staff is they're exposed continually to the virus? I mean, I've seen some immunologists arguing you've got to be in contact with an infected person for 20 minutes to have a realistic chance to get the infection yourself. But that's not been debated. So we've all been socially distancing. But actually, I think if you force me to say, is it safer to be socially distanced or have a mask? I'd probably go with a mask and gloves, because you take it in through your eyes, mainly through your nose and your mouth, and possibly through your skin. So protecting yourself in that way, probably better for you than actually just keeping your distance.
But do you wear a mask and gloves when you go shopping?
No, because I don't go shopping. I've got other people. I've got staff.
You've got staff, have you?
No, I haven't. My youngest, in his contribution to the household, does the shopping on behalf of the household. So he's a 19-year-old back from university. So
have you not been out of the house for the last...
I have, in fairness, I have been out of the house, but I've certainly been very careful about where I've gone and how long I've gone out for. I mean, my wife and I go out every morning.
Let's imagine that you went out to the supermarket. Would you wear a mask and gloves?
If I have actually got out of the car and gone into the supermarket, which I haven't, I would. Yes, I would, for sure. So I think hygiene was my point. Hygiene, we're going to be much more thoughtful about what do we think is appropriate hygiene measures for us and our family. And as I was saying, we did a whole webinar, which has probably been the most watched of all the webinars, on mental health strategies that work and don't work.
Yeah. Quite a long way, actually, Anna.
Yeah. Well, I think, you know, people are very concerned about that. And what we were saying on that particular webinar is, you know, as lovely as it might be to do, you know, a yoga course in your home, that's not really going to move the dial today. You know, getting good at yoga isn't going to move the dial on your emotional well-being and mental health right now. It might do a temporary blip, but there are things that you can do that can move the dial. And that's what that whole webinar was about. Mental health strategies that will work for you today and have a much larger impact. So that's going to be critical. And I think, you know, if humanity starts to regulate its emotional state to a much higher degree, then that will be a huge leap forward for all of us. And we talked also in relation to that emotional regulation and finding meaning is, if people are a bit more thoughtful, a bit more reflective about, well, what do they really want from their life? What do they want from their work? You know, do they want to be in contact at work? Do they want to go back to work? Do they want to work from home permanently? We've seen some tech companies saying, you know, you can work from home forever. Well, do I want that? I mean, what's the meaning of my work experience? So people sort of being a bit more thoughtful and reflective, what do I want from my life, will be a good thing. So again, a silver lining, you know, that's really us waking up to what matters to us and then maybe growing up and taking a much more sort of circumspect view about whether, you know, we keep having to sort of run ourselves to a point of exhaustion to make a load of money and then make ourselves ill and we have to spend all the money getting ourselves healthy again. So people need to think about those sorts of things.
Can I just pause you there? Just a couple of questions while we're on this theme. Part of the issue for me is a declining feeling of much to look forward to at the moment. How can we cling on to positive thoughts?
Well, that's the whole debate about meaning. And by the way, it's not positive thoughts. Positive thoughts don't cut it. That's a mental health strategy that doesn't work. It's positive feelings that cut it. And there's a difference between a thought and a feeling. So if you feel positive, not just think positive, so it's thinking happy thoughts won't be enough. You've got to feel it in your body. So the sort of simple distinction is a feeling is an experience below the neck. So think of it like that. A thought is above the eyebrows. So if you feel positive, then that will be helpful. But the question was really about, you know, given it's very difficult, you know, how can we feel more positive, more optimistic, and more hopeful about the future? Now, I think that is about meaning. If enough human beings can go, you know what, maybe we have been living wrong. Maybe, you know, we have been charging around too much travel, too much work intensity, too much sort of consumerism. You know, maybe we've got enough. You know, maybe we need to live a little bit more locally, a little bit more, you know, within our means. Maybe we don't need to run up quite as much debt. Maybe actually if we all learned to manage our anxiety and our panic a bit better, the world would be a better place. So those are some of the optimistic things that I think about in terms of what have we got to look forward towards the future. So that's one thing. But more important than that, perhaps, is if I can change me as a result of this crisis and I start living my life differently in a more optimistic, more hopeful, more resilient way, you know, with greater levels of compassion, then maybe I can look forward towards that. Maybe I can look forward to a time where not only I live that way, but others live that way too. And maybe I can look forward to a time where I help others live that way. So, you know, create your own meaning, create your own change, you know, and that's the Gandhi quote, you know, be the change you want to see in the world. So if you want to see a better tomorrow, start creating it. And that starts with me personally. I'm going to create my own future. And a very simple thing you can do is actually just, despite the difficulties, is just start taking a more upbeat, optimistic perspective. So we're not trapped at home, we're safe at home, you know, and feeling appreciation for all that we have and all that we are right now, you know, that can be an optimistic future. So that would be my sort of quick answer to that question.
Okay, one quick one. Do you think that we'll have a problem maintaining medical staff? As a nurse I know in Sweden who's in intensive care is about to leave and believes many others will.
Yes, I think that will be a problem. And I think there needs to be a whole scale overhaul and thinking about health system delivery, health system funding, health system leadership. But the trouble we have in the UK is that's an impossible conversation to have right now because the NHS has become a religion in the UK. You know, that it's almost, we sort of have a fundamentalist attitude. And we, of course, we all care deeply. I mean, I worked in the NHS for 12 years. We care deeply about the system. But it's impossible to have any kind of robust debate about how we improve the system, because as soon as anybody says anything about the NHS, they're castigated as attacking the NHS and everybody wants to save our NHS. So we haven't really been able to have a mature, sophisticated debate about health system leadership, you know, to the point and the question, you know, recruitment of staff, compassionate support for those staff, whether it's through PPE or just how they interact with each other. And we really need a much more sophisticated, nuanced debate about, you know, health systems, not just in the UK, in every country in the world. So, you know, if we can get to that, that will be a better outcome.
Another quick question. I know I'm holding you up here at the moment. Is social distancing the right term as it affects the mental well-being? Should it be physical distancing, as we can still be sociable, but just rethink the vocabulary?
I agree. You know, we have to be very careful about the language. And I think we've talked about this already, about the unbelievable combative narrative. You know, it's a war and, you know, we've got to kill this and do, you know, we have to be really careful. I mean, the only reason I use some of the sort of standard phrases is they've become currency and people know what you mean. But I totally agree. In fact, I've done recently a piece of work suggesting, you know, what do we need to do moving forward in relation to mental health? And as you know, on that particular webinar, saying, look, it's not mental, it's not health, it's emotional well-being. It's not mental health because it's not affecting mentation, it's affecting emotion. So that's a relanguaging. So the point about relanguage is not just changing the labels, is these words matter. So I totally agree with that question, is we need to get much more precise in the way that we talk about these things, because it makes a difference, not only in terms of how we feel about the issue, but in terms of mental health. If we consider and we recognize that actually it's about emotional well-being, it then gives us something very useful to focus on, because these problems aren't mental, they're largely emotional, and they're largely a development issue, not a health issue. So if people develop much higher levels of emotional regulation, they don't get the health problems. So I totally agree with that point about, you know, labels matter. So again, new horizons, we talked about emotional well-being and meaning. So home is going to be massive, you know, not just working from home, but, you know, lots of people started cooking for the first time. And I remember going back a year or so, Jamie Oliver appearing on every sort of show he could get onto, talking about the importance of cooking and cooking from home. And, you know, Heston Blumenthal says actually in schools, there should only be one, you know, forget maths and German and geography, just do cooking. Cooking covers everything because it covers biology and chemistry and math. You got to weigh things out. We should just have one lesson, cooking. I mean, that's kind of Heston's view. But people have started cooking who never cooked. So
have
that's
you,
going to be. I have. My speciality du maison, something called dragon's tail. It's lamb. I've rolled that out, literally. So I think home working, home cooking, eating at home is going to become bigger, whether it's delivered or we just cook at home. So I think people are going to become much more focused on their home experience, entertainment, much more at home, you know, through different streaming services, video on demand. I think we're going to see a massive spike and change in consumer behavior in relation to whether they do things in the home or out of the home. So I think that's going to be massive. So companies need to be tuned into that. I think in addition to that, we're going to be more local, you know, and people have discovered, you know, there's a lovely walk. I never realized it until I started venturing out that there was actually a lovely walk near here. So people have become much more locally focused. So I think that will affect food supply. So where's the food grown? So food supply chains will be more local. We might get more seasonal vegetables and so on. Food consumption will be more local. So I think businesses may be globally aware, but the delivery of products and services will be much more local. So I think that's going to be a big shift around the planet, this sort of local sort of dimension, globally aware, but locally delivered, as I've written there. And I think there's going to be a big change in terms of communities. So I think we're going to see a softening of the ethnocentric focus on nation states. I think what we'll see, and by the way, that was a trend that was already happening pre-COVID. You know, as cities started to connect to each other and say, well, look, you know, Bogota has much more in common than Paris than it has with some of its own local cities. So not so much twinning, but almost sort of political connections and also problem solving. So some of the problems that you see in Paris may be more similar to problems that you see in Tel Aviv than they may be to Lyon. So we'll start to see sharing across national boundaries. City politics will start to become even more important. And we've already started to see that trend in the UK with mayors and so on. And it will be the devolution of power. And that trend had already started. And I think that's going to continue massively and expand. Devolved power. Because you get smarter answers if you devolve the power and the decision-making capability to the people who are affected by that decision. And that was one of the underlying trends that triggered Brexit, by the way. So I think local and communities are going to become a much bigger thing, and business is going to change dramatically. And frankly, it needs to, because, you know, money does still make the world go round and will for some time to come. So the business narrative that we talked about recently in one of the webinars is going to be huge. So, you know, we're starting to wake up. Actually, people are more important than profit. And what's more important than people is the planet itself, because if we don't take care of the planet, there won't be any people. And if there's no people, then you haven't got any profit. So I think people are waking up to that. And as we talked before, you know, deliberately developmental organizations where development as a phenomena is central to the corporate strategy. And HR directors will become chief development officers. So I think business is going to change out of all recognition. Innovation is going to transform. And I'm doing a book called Innovation Sucks at the moment, because the current view of sort of R&D funnels where you push a product to market will be completely reversed. The market will pull the answer. So it will literally suck the answer out of innovation engines. So we're going to see innovation change out of all recognition. Change itself will change. So the way that we think about change, and any leader has to become an absolute sort of expert, super knowledgeable about changing themselves, changing the team, changing the organization, because we're in super changeable times. So if you don't really understand or are scared by change, then you're going to get swept up by it. So leaders really have a responsibility to understand change at a whole new level and become change agents, skillful change agents, and change for the better is what I really mean there. You know, game changing.
Just for leaders, or is that for anybody?
For everybody, frankly. But what we've seen a lot of the time is people, you know, gaming the change rather than changing the game. You know, and we need to learn to change the game is a fundamental difference. So not pretending like we've changed, like you see in many political leaders, pretending we're changing something, actually changing something and getting good at that, and getting good at telling the stories of change. And it's a very positive thing. So to one of the earlier questions, how can we be optimistic about the future? One of the reasons many people are pessimistic about the future is people are gaming the change. They're not changing the game. So that's not good enough anymore. We have to change the game, you know, for ourselves, for our communities and for our businesses and organizations. And then finally, I think we're going to see people reclaiming the truth. So we live in a post-truth world, as we've talked about earlier on. People are going to start to reclaim the truth, I believe. You know, fact-checking will start to become a community issue because whoever controls the narrative has the power. And we're starting to see that. So the sharp end of that debate in terms of reclaiming the truth is actually going on in Hong Kong right now. And so anybody that's following the media will have seen that, you know, authoritarian regimes are trying to now reassert their power and their control in Hong Kong, and the people are resisting. So just share with some very interesting statistics. If you looked at the 1st of April, the death rate in New York City, which is 8.3 million people, and the death rate in Hong Kong, 7.5 million people. So relatively similar sized cities. The death toll in New York at 1st of April was 1,000. In Hong Kong, it's 4. By May the 1st, 23,500 in New York. In Hong Kong, still 4. So there's something really, really interesting. And there's some very interesting articles and conversations on the internet about, well, why is that? First of all, is the data true? But if it's even partially true, why is there such a profound difference in the death rate? Because it's probably more densely populated in Hong Kong than it is in New York. So how can you have such a profound difference? And I think it's
also partly closer to China as well. Well, yeah. In fact, it is part of China.
It is part of China, right? Exactly. You know your geography, Katie. So you would have expected it to be massively affected, and it hasn't. And I think one of the reasons for that is the population reclaimed the power. And interesting, a lot of those networks that were resisting, you know, the overall of democratic process in Hong Kong, when COVID hit, they completely switched, and they used a lot of social media platforms to inform each other about the hotspots on Hong Kong Island before the government even said anything. In fact, many of the people started working from home at the first whiff of a problem in Wuhan. They all masked up, gloved up, still were very packed in with each other, but they started to work from home before the government said anything at all. That's people power. So I think we're going to see a shift, and we're starting to see other examples of that around the world. As populations get more informed, wake up and grow up, the power balance is going to start to shift. So if we want to be optimistic about the future, I think we're on the cusp of a significant reclaiming of the power by the people, because people are fed up with poor quality leadership, with messages that don't really move the dial. And hopefully that will enable them to wake up and grow up and step up and start to create the future that will benefit all of us.
I think one of the interesting things about the Hong Kong movement is actually who's doing it. And it's quite a younger demographic. And that's quite interesting in itself, because there are a generation that's grown up with social media and the ability to cohere groups quite quickly.
Yes. And often the agents of change are a younger generation, where they see the mess that, frankly, you're my generation have made of things, and it's not good enough. And I agree with that. You know, we've got to do better, and we can do better. And that's what excites me. Is despite these incredible wicked problems, and as I said, COVID is just the latest, there's some real simple things we can do today that can make a profound difference. And so that's what we need to start doing. You know, all of us taking individual responsibility, not waiting for governments, not waiting for bosses or organizations or somebody else to be the change ourselves. We can start doing things, all of us, now, today, that can make a better tomorrow.
And it's like the people power. Jyoti says that Hong Kong had queues starting at 5:30 a.m. to buy masks. They sold out at fabulous premiums. You were glared at till you wilted if you entered a tram without a mask.
Mm. Yeah. Yeah. So, you know, sort of social peer pressure. And this is the reclaiming of the power is if you want to live in this community, you're going to have to behave appropriately and fairly in line, because it's not just, you can't be afford to be selfish and just think about what you do or do not want to do. This is about all of us, not just you. You may not want to wear a mask, but you're living amongst us and we need you to wear a mask. So I think it's that type of narrative that's part of being a mature adult. So, you know, and it goes back to something we talked about earlier on is we are not alone and isolated. Mm. You know, we're not, we're connected to each other. I mean, if COVID teaches us nothing, we're globalized. We are all connected. We're in this together and we have to acknowledge that and start to learn a different way of operating, a more mature, a more compassionate, a more collaborative kind of, because as we discussed before, that's really who we are. We are social animals. We are built on collaboration, not competition.
Quick question, more of a practical question. Is this the end for face-to-face corporate meetings and events? This question is from an event agency owner.
No, good news, no, it isn't. I mean, I did an event yesterday evening, a digital event, a virtual event to 3,000 people, largely in the States. So there's going to be a big surge in digital event hosting. So I think if you're an events company, you've got to get into digital. Probably at least 50% of all the business moving forward for an events company will be digital. But for the super complex wicked issues, digital online event is just not as good as face-to-face. So when you're dealing, I think in corporations, I think we'll see a massive reduction in travel and all the cost savings that go with that. But I think for the really super complex stuff, you know, human beings being such social animals, being in the presence of each other, but we'll maybe hopefully be a bit more circumspect and won't travel around quite as much. But the super complex stuff, you need to be in the room with each other. So I think that will still be the case. So I think for an events company, it's the quality and complexity of the question that event might be leaning into. You know, when you take on some big issues, you need to be present with each other. So maybe my encouragement would be do the virtual stuff for a lot of the more straightforward issues, but certainly for the wicked issues, the complex issues, if you start to convene something about the bigger ticket items, if you will, then we're going to need to be face-to-face with each other.
Another question. I noticed in recent weeks, people have moved towards blame and witch hunting. Is this typical behavior after such significant events?
Absolutely typical. I mean, many human beings feel threatened. They live on the edge of fear and threat all the time. So anything slightly perturbs, which goes to two points. We have to get better at emotional regulation, because once we feel threatened, our biology goes into chaos, our brain shuts down, we make poor choices. So we've got to get emotional regulation, number one. Number two, we've got to get better at change, you know. Yes, things are changing, and we shouldn't perceive that as a threat, because it's just as likely to be an opportunity to make the world better. But, you know, number one, we don't emotionally regulate. Number two, we're not very good with change, which is sort of weird because the world is changing incredibly. So if we don't, every one of us, get better at, you know, leaning into change and seeing change as a positive thing, then we're going to have a very difficult future, because the world's getting faster and faster in its ability to change. So I often talk about something called knowledge doubling. Knowledge used to double every 25 years post-World War II, and now it's every 12 months. So the entirety of human knowledge is doubling every year, and IBM have calculated that will get down to 12 hours. So the entirety of human knowledge will be doubling every day. Now that's an incredible pace of change. So if we're not very good with change, we're just going to get swept up in it and feel even more helpless. So there's a responsibility on all of us. We've got to get really, really good at feeling positive about change, leaning into change, guiding and steering change, going with the change, being the change.
Thanks, Alan. Question from Ali in the States. Can you speak a bit more about the politics of this virus? I live in the US, and in many ways, it doesn't feel like we're doing better. Even wearing a mask is a political issue, and people are marching in state houses with automatic weapons and asking for the country to be opened up. it doesn't feel like we're in this together.
No, and that's it, it's a much, much deeper issue that. So it's rather interesting that people try to make something because, you know, without national boundaries or without political boundaries, like a virus, like the virus doesn't vote, doesn't care whether you're a Republican or a Democrat. So why has it become a political issue? And it's just because we're immature in our relationships. Right? We haven't really grown up. Human beings, as I talked one of the earlier webinars, is it took bacteria a billion years to stop killing each other and collaborate. And the first collaboration was nucleation. It shared DNA, cytomatic DNA, put it in a nucleus, became the library of genetic material, if you will. So a billion years, it took bacteria a billion years to do that bit of collaboration, and they all started killing each other. It took another billion years for bacteria to realize, more energy efficient to collaborate than to kill each other, and then multicellular organisms. So that took 2 billion years for bacteria to get good at collaboration. And human beings just haven't grown up enough. So we're just not good at collaborating. You know, we like to polarize things, Republican, Democrat, flip-flop. And that goes on all around the world. And this sort of mistaken belief that, you know, it's an us versus them world. It's this combative metaphor. But it's just not true. I mean, we are collaborative at our core. But we've got to grow up and mature into that. And human beings aren't maturing fast enough yet. And many people in their primary relationship, if you look at the divorce rate around many industrialized, it's at least 50%. The person who you make a choice to get married to, the most important person in your life, 50% of the time that fails. That's not a great record. That just alludes to how immature we are in our inability to get on with each other and to relate with each other. There's still lots of conflicts in the world. I mean, it's a lot better than it was 500 years ago. We are definitely getting better. But the real question is, are we getting better quick enough? And currently, it looks like we're not. So those sort of, you know, political bits of nonsense that are going on in the States, you know, where they've made COVID a political issue or the response to COVID a political issue, you know, that all that really tells me is we can't put our political differences aside for the sake of all of us, for the sake of humanity. And that's because we're too immature right now. And so the real issue is we've got to wake up and grow up. If we grow up, then we start to realize, you know, there's much less of a separation between you and I than we think. And that's a sign of maturity. So the real underlying issue that's driving all of that nonsense is a lack of maturity, in my view.
Alan, there's kind of one, I suppose, one question that might be a good question to end on is, with these new horizons, what would your top recommendations be to leaders now, in addition to them being change agents?
Well, as I keep repeating, what do I do? What do I do? You know, that question comes up. So what do I personally do? What do our leaders do? You know, like, it comes up all the time. And I always give the same response, because without emotional regulation, if you don't, first of all, get your own house in order, if you don't, first of all, manage your fear, your sense of threat, your sense of overwhelm, your stress, your panic, then the biology is in chaos, the frontal lobes shut down, and you make bad choices. So the first port of call, the first answer would always be, first manage yourself before you try and do anything else. And it's a little bit like, you know, that oxygen mask in the airplane. First put your own on, then deal with your child. First, it's sort of, if you like, legalized selfishness. You've got to deal with yourself first. You've got to deal with the fact that you're in the inappropriate emotional state. Because if you don't deal with that, you don't think clearly. And if you can't think clearly, nothing else will work. So my number one step, like, before you do anything else at all, get really good at regulating your own emotions. Become fascinated with the fact. I mean, that's the thing that differentiates human beings from animals. Is animals have emotions, is they just don't have self-awareness in relation to their emotions. So it's something quintessentially human. It's what makes our life meaningful. If we climbed Mount Everest and didn't feel a sense of achievement, it would have been pointless climbing Mount Everest. Emotions are an incredibly fascinating core element of who we are. It influences our decision-making. It gives our life meaning. It completely alters our health and our risk. So let's become fascinated. Let's fall back in love with the whole agenda, particularly for men, I might say, with the whole agenda of emotions and feelings. And it's a beautiful topic. And I can honestly promise you that it's possible to live your life without fear, without this constant worry about anxiety or depression. It's possible to completely heal all that stuff, but we have to lean into the agenda. We have to become fascinated and curious, and completely curious, if I might say, about who we are as emotional beings rather than logical beings. And if we do that, then we will create a different world.
And can I recommend a good book called 4D Leadership that might be a good a place as any to start and understand some of the phenomena that that Alan's been talking about. And thank you for those who've sent in some topics: imposter syndrome, fear, leadership through business, all good topics. If you haven't thought of anything and you want to send something in at complete-coherence.com, that would be really helpful. And over the last 10 webinars, we've tried to provoke some thought. And I'd like to say that if you need a thinking partner, you'd like a thinking partner to help your business to change fast, efficiently, that's really where we're coming from. So please do very much get in touch with any of us here at Complete. So it just remains for me to say thank you to everybody here. Thank you, Alan. Really, really appreciate your time, effort, dedication, care. Dare I say love, even. This is something that is, I know, extremely important to you day in, day out, and pretty much dedicating your life to this. So I'd like to thank you very much for that indeed, and to thank you guys. And we'll be in touch very soon. Thanks a lot. Bye-bye.
Thank you.
If we've piqued your curiosity or you've enjoyed anything we've talked about in this podcast, please subscribe, email us, or just visit our website at complete-coherence.com.